The intelligent network was this radical thought that you could do applications like number translation, so you could translate an 800 number into a normal telephone number, but at the same time take a billing record and kind of reverse who the paying party was. Why, you could even record the touch tones and charge a calling card based on the touch tones you recorded. You could even make an announcement that said that we're sorry the party is not here, would you care to leave a message, and then record the message. I mean, and these were amazing new capabilities.
And you could charge for all of these applications.
And you could charge
if you're the phone company. Could.
But the intelligent network was a vision whereby those kinds of there were application platforms defined for those what were to the telephone company radical applications of the time, and they were conceived of as being in the middle of the network, owned, controlled, etc., and charged for by the telephone companies.
So what we have now is the programmable, the old telephone system becomes programmable, uh-huh. but only by the telephone company.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than the ends of the network being the users, so the big choice that you get as a user is you can, at some point, they actually allow you to buy a princess phone, but that's about the extent of the options. And all of a whole new layer of services get put in by the phone company, for which they offer them to you for sale, so it becomes an important part of their business model. Is that... about the for sale stuff.
It does become a part of their business model. They don't really know how to sell things like call forwarding and the class services were something they really had trouble with for almost a decade.
I mean, my telephone company still wants to charge me $7 a month. The caller ID.
Caller ID.
Which is the most expensive per bit information transfer since,
On the other hand, if you have to have it, you have to have it.
You know? Not at that price.
My wife, to my...
Sorry, I just screwed his podcast. Subtle, but
sorry. We know whose podcast wins now.
In your face.
So what's the stupid network? That's smart network.
Well, hang on. The intelligent network was sort of based on the fact that as computing capabilities grew, only the telephone companies would ever know about it and ever be able to take advantage of it. And it's sort of like when time sharing computers were based on the fact of a very expensive centralized resource that people could share, right? The telephone network was the same way, but they never thought it would change. Whereas with time sharing computers, I mean, they were owned by small enough entities, and that when they became obsolete, people just went out and bought PCs, and the time-sharing machines kind of faded into the back closets.
Okay.
So the stupid network was, the internet. It was a network that was not centrally controlled, that the applications were all at the edges in people's machines. It wasn't centrally planned. Like, the telephone companies had this, they knew where the next 4ESS was going to go 5 years, in 2010, back when in 1975, they knew which switches were going to get installed in 1976, 77, 78, 79, 80, and they went about acquiring the land and building the buildings. And, you know, sort of, it was just totally under control, and it was a very nicely well-oiled machine. But now along comes this internet thing, completely out of the blue, and the way it works is one hippie calls up another hippie and goes, can I connect to you? And, you know, the answer was always yes, and let me help you. And before you knew it, there was this incredibly well-functioning network that nobody owned, nobody controlled, nobody really charged for, and that was the home to all of the new innovative applications. And so that was my model for the stupid network. Now, was it ever a perfectly stupid network with nothing ever in the middle? And I mean, well, you know, we can talk about that if you want to, but you probably have other questions you'd rather ask.
Well, since let's come back to that, since the battleground these days is over what constitutes, in addition to the center of the network, that will maintain the virtues of the stupid network. So one of the advantages of stupid network, there's a set of architectural advantages, and then there are a set of economic political advantages, such as increased innovation, allowing edges to innovate. Can you talk for a minute about the architectural advantages? Why is a stupid network better than a smart one, in terms of, for example, its resilience or other such things?
Well, because it's unowned and unplanned and so on, it there can be multiple. It can have multiple routes, or you could say that a failure at any one point doesn't kill the whole network. Unlike AT&T, which in something like 1993, literally some programmer missed a semicolon, and the generic got cut over on the same day in every switch in the country in lockstep fashion, and the whole network went down. It was just amazing. And that just basically, you know, even though the internet has had major attacks and all kinds of stuff, it's so heterogeneous it couldn't possibly go down. Plus, it's really simple, so any failure modes are likely to be local failure modes. So that's the main architectural advantage. And it's because it's based on local area networking technology. Well, it isn't based on, the stupid network could be dial-up. The stupid network could be carrier pigeons or smoke signals. Of course, the latency would be slightly longer.
But voice over smoke signals are unlikely to succeed. Jitter.
Wind.
So then there's the fact that the stupid network allows innovation at the edges, so you don't have to get permission from the center, in this case the phone company, in order to add something as radical as caller ID. Mm-hmm. And that's a property of the network, right? I mean, the innovation happens because
the barriers are really low and nobody needs to ask permission. Exactly.
So I want to take you down.
Oh, and then there's another really important thing that that I think I talked to Jay-Z a little bit about by chat today. The internet just accidentally happens to be an incredibly cheap and effective market research vehicle. So if you do invent a new application and put it out there, you know, you can see whether people like it or not. And to me, that just between us Berkmanites, if you're familiar with the red switch, green switch paradigm the red switch, green switch meme or idea Jonathan Zittrain has, where when a computer, say you've got a laptop, when it's in red switch mode, then it's hyper protected and it rejects everything that it doesn't know about in advance and it only does what's expected of it. Whereas when it's in green switch mode, anything goes. It can download and install viruses and worms and new applications that it never saw before and all kinds of neat stuff.
Pornography and terrorist literature. And
right, exactly. The whole...
Uh-huh. Freedom of speech, man.
Yeah.
For example, yeah.
Uh-huh. But it would be illegal to do it on somebody else's Wi-Fi now.
Absolutely.
if most people, most of the time, ran in protected red switch mode, except, say, when they were playing games or, surfing for kiddie porn or something like that, then the market, I'm afraid that the fast market test aspect would become much less powerful.
So this brings me to sort of the next, and from my point, the last clump I want to ask you about.
Okay.
I want to leave lots of time.
Yeah, sure.
So Jonathan Zittrain's red switch, green switch thing, as I understand it, is a response to increasing push by regulators and by large monopolistic companies and others, much of which is well-intentioned, but some of which isn't, but much of which is well-intentioned.
Most of which is not well-intentioned, some of which is naively ill-intentioned spouted by either naive or well-intentioned people, in my humble opinion.
Who look at the internet and see all the dangers. All they see is risk, basically. They see the terrorist network, they see the kiddie porn network, and the virus and malware networks. Mm-hmm. And they want to, for whatever reason, we'll leave attention out for the moment, they want to protect users from all these bad things. And so they want to, through a variety of schemes, are reintroducing into our stupid network, that is, into the internet whose job it is and has succeeded because its only job has been to move bits from A to B, and it doesn't care what the bits are or who's sending them, which is why the barriers are so low.
Well said.
They want to put into the middle of this thing some set of mechanisms in order to protect us from all these bad things. So as I understand Jonathan's proposal, or his meme, I'm not sure it's actually a proposal, I don't know. This is a way of,
it's an idea right now. Yeah.
You can have that so long as we can turn it off, because you can't really decide for me what is a virus. And the excellent example today at a meeting, discussion we had, was Paul
Hoffer
said something along the lines of, well, to the Chinese government, the word freedom is a virus.
Uh-huh.
So let's have a compromise. We can have your protection stuff so long as we can turn it off. We can green switch it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, what's in this battle between the new forces of the stupid network and the entrenched incumbent forces of intelligent networks? Where are we? I'm totally depressed. I mean, I'm completely, totally depressed. Mm-hmm. I think we're doomed.
Mm-hmm.
But you are not quite as depressed, I hope.
So
where are we?
It's hard to say where we are until we're further down the road and couldn't look back and go, oh, that's where we were, because it's complicated and a lot of things are going on. Right, where are we is right now we have had several bad Supreme Court decisions, and the Supreme Court is unlikely to get any better. We have had some bad FCC rulings, and specifically I'm talking about the Supreme Court Brand X decision and the immediately subsequent FCC DSL decision, which both of them basically said that the two major ways we get broadband in this country can abandon most of their common carrier principles.
Which means that that competitors who want to use their facilities no longer are, they can say no to the competitors.
Yeah, and so even more, it opens the door. I'm not sure, you know, the lawyers may quibble with whether these specific decisions opens this specific door, but the door is opening so that, for example, if you type in travel to and you're on Comcast, you get Orbitz, and if you type in travel and you're on Verizon, you get cheap tickets, because Orbitz and cheap tickets made private commercial arrangements with those two guys. And more likely, you'll get these vertical monopolies where the airline, the travel agency, the rent-a-car agency, the hotel chain, and the ISP, and you go with that group of services. And it reminds me sort of the robber baron days on the railroads, which is why they started to impose common carriage regulations on the railroads, where the railroad owner basically told the farmer what he would pay for the grain, and told on the one end, and told the flour mill that he was delivering it to what he would sell it to the flour mill for. And
so the consequence of this, as I understand it, is that you would like to see a principle by which there's a separation, a business separation, between the layer that carries the bits and the layers that provide services on top of the bits, or with the result that this layer that moves bits around, it can't make money by doing the sort of intelligent network thing of providing centralized services. We want to keep that from happening. But that leaves the companies that are moving the bits in a sort of low cost, low price commodity market, and which is tough to tell a company that you've got to be happy just with moving the bits. Are we ever going to get there?
Well, that's only one of many potential evolutions. I mean, the most. Suppose that in 3 more years we have a new president from a different party and a new FCC that thinks differently about regulation and maybe says two monopolies is not competition, that says here in the law encourage competition. And that's the Telecom Act of 1996. Let's get back to that, or something like that. The current regime is not cast in stone, so better regulation could break out. Whether it'll be good or not, or just different, we'll see. That's one thing that might happen to bring us out of our... second thing that might happen is that all the time, Moore's law is working its magic, and you can now have as many angels dance, well, maybe not on the head of a pin, but on the head of a little tiny device, about that big, and these devices can relay packets to each other, and no big telephone company has to own them, and so potentially, the internet started this way as sort of a stealth thing that just wasn't relevant to the telephone companies, and it could be that the internet will continue, the internet that we know and love, the stupid network, will continue to evolve under the radar of the big companies. The big companies could think that, well, now we're going to own the internet and fix the internet and make it reliable and keep it, from being a cesspool and all that. But meanwhile, the real internet is still under development by the same guys that have always been developing the real internet. So that's a second way out. And a third way out is that maybe somebody can figure out how to make a viable business that subsidizes an increasingly cheap commodity, and meanwhile that viable business disrupts the people who are earning artificially propped up profit margins on a decreasing cost basis, who can really ride the curves down.
So for bandwidth.
For bandwidth, for cool applications, for all, I'm thinking very specifically of a company that starts with G and has as its motto, don't be evil.
Hold on. Would somebody Google that?
See, we can't live without it, and it gives us all these incredible applications. And meanwhile, have an open mind. You don't want to have an open mind? Okay.
Been watching. I've been watching.
You've been watching them.
So actually,
I've been watching. So has Wall Street.
Yes.
So, David, I mean, they're investing in power line stuff. So let's Google.
Yeah. Okay.
So let's just assume, let's pretend for the moment that they, tomorrow, because they move pretty fast, but tomorrow they announce Google Broadband.
Yeah.
Over power lines as a competitor.
Yeah.
So now we have a don't be evil company that's offering to move bits, but is also providing a whole range of services on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that rebuilding the intelligent network, just with a better-hearted company than?
Well, it depends on whether they rebuild the intelligent network or not. I mean, if what they do is offer Google Broadband as a connect, anything connects to anything, and we don't care what the contents of our packets
what
are.
Or what email application you use on top of it.
Yeah, even though they offer Gmail, they're not, Gmail per se isn't their profit center. They mine whatever you choose to use, and they mine it for personal information and use that personal information for their, for their profit center. And so they don't have a really, they'd rather you use Gmail, but whatever you use of Google's, it'll generate enough knowledge for them about you so they can serve ads that are relevant to you on the average, that they'll be useful to their customers who are the companies that have stuff to sell you.
So therefore, they don't have to do the evil thing of saying, sure, you can have Google Broadband at an incredible low price.
It will be. It'll be free.
But you have to use Gmail, and when you try to go to Yahoo Search, it just doesn't go there. Uh-huh. So as long as it's generally open access to all the applications, then you get past the.
If they said if they locked you out of Yahoo Search and locked you out of, locked down your port 25 so you couldn't SMTP to the server of your choice. Would be, I think the current scheme, the current management would say that is evil, and they wouldn't do it.
Yep.
Could that change? Sure it could. Could they not succeed at the mission that I believe that they're on? Sure they could. But is it a plausible scenario? I believe that it is. So there are, and if not, there's still the possibility that some company somehow will figure out a way to make a viable business out of the stupid network. And I mean the stupid, without changing it into the intelligent network. And if I knew how to do that, I would not be sitting here at the Berkman Center shooting my mouth off.
You'd be off being stupid.
I would be off doing it. Anyway, that's a good point to.
So, let me suggest some areas. David knows, everything about telecommunications and about the industry. He's also been very deeply involved in the political side of it, which is the political side of stupid network is freedom to connect. Right? It's essentially what it is. So that's another area in which you may want to poke at them.
Here's the question. We talk about open networks, stupid networks, in reference to cellular phones, the way cell phone networks are run, and the walled garden software experience we all get with our cell phones.
Mm-hmm. I think that the current cellular industry, mobile telephony industry, as it's currently conceived, is a wall. It's clearly it's the last bastion of the intelligent network. It's still a walled garden. They control the value proposition from top to bottom for the most part. I mean, not entirely. This thing still generates touch tones, which means you can go on to, say, a home banking application and go beep, beep, beep and hear your bank balance, and they don't get any more than the airtime for that, even though they love to, because touch tones are a form of end-to-end signaling. And if they could take touch tones back, they would. So you're right that the cellular network is closed. Fortunately, it's not only ripe for disruption, but the disruptors are in sight. 2 years ago, I had the astounding experience of walking around the conference floor untethered with a compact palm top in my hand with the Wi-Fi card in it and an earphone, talking and hearing someone in first in Stockholm and then in San Francisco. I was in Atlanta, talking, and it sounded better than the telephone network. And it was voice over IP. It was piece of shrink-wrapped software running inside this compact. It was vanilla Wi-Fi from the compact to an access point. It was vanilla internet from that access point out into the internet. There was no QoS or anything on it. It was just the internet. And at the other end, that the fellow was talking on some kind of vanilla computer running the same program. And it sounded great. So now there are Wi-Fi phones that are starting to come out now that don't use the, that look like phones, but they're really computers with the voice processing algorithm inside. And they don't use the conventional cellular network at all. They use Wi-Fi, which is in more and more places except at Harvard University.
At the moment. Be bitter.
And I don't know. I expect more from, you come to my house and my Wi-Fi is down, I'm embarrassed, I will tell you. Seriously embarrassed. I consider that, you know, my guests ought to have it, that the people walking down the street, if they want to use
it, should
have
it. Get past it.
So anyway, so I think that pretty soon there will be Wi-Fi capable platforms that do voice just fine wherever you are, that have the potential to disrupt the cell phone industry because they can do more cool applications. What are they? We don't know yet because there's not enough out there. But when there starts to be enough out there and people start to develop applications for them that are more than just talky-talky, listen-listen, it'll blow the... I think what's going to happen is that there are going to be internet communicators that'll be such a rich experience that you only use the telephone when you don't have one of those.
So let me be gloomy, because we heard the CTO of AT&T today say that having just found out that people are sharing open Wi-Fi access points, that clearly this is theft of service.
He did.
Oh, absolutely.
He did. Wow. He did.
He was not ambivalent about it. Of course it's thievery. Read your service contract.
And he said he knows this because he read about it, about somebody sharing their DSL line with their neighbors in the paper.
So why aren't we one bill in Congress away from declaring that using somebody else's Wi-Fi is theft of services, shutting down the bottom-up Wi-Fi clouds that enable the sort of Wi-Fi phone calls, a voice over IP using Wi-Fi that is the blow to the current cellular network?
We're increasingly one bill away from a whole lot of really bad things. There's a minority of senators and congressmen that still aren't complete, you know, they aren't bought and sold for in everything they do, and have a little bit of common sense and respect for the citizens of their country. It's entirely plausible that that bill could come. In fact, it's worse than that. The FCC has already been talking about remember PAL's four network freedoms, the freedom to attach devices, freedom to run applications.
Michael Powell,
when he was FCC chairman, freedom to attach devices, freedom to run applications, freedom to, to have freedom of choice, I believe, was the third one, and then freedom to know your service plan information was the fourth one. The new FCC chairman, Kevin Martin, has rewritten them to read freedom to attach devices as long as they don't interfere with the integrity of the network or violate your service plan. Freedom to to run applications as long as they don't violate your service plan or interfere with the integrity of the network. No, basically he's nixed everything. So what you say is a plausible short-term outcome, but maybe there would be a lot of pretty angry people if that happened. Yes.
The question comes to mind, and this is something that I keep wrestling with. As I hear you speak about the telecom industry, I see a more, and again, particularly the regulatory environment, or not, I see an increasingly paternalistic environment. Yet, if you listen to the rhetoric, I keep hearing for everything else, we're to be smarter healthcare consumers. We're to be, quote, consumerism. We should be self-driven, not have this. Is it, and the thing I struggle with, really, and I just throw this out, is if it's going to line someone else's pocket, we are paternalistic about it. If it's going to save somebody one of these a dime, we are consumeristic about it. Am I crazy? Or does this construct make any sense? By that I'm saying, for instance, healthcare costs, they're shifted back to the consumer, and we're advocating avidly consumerism in health. We avidly say, save a dime, have your own retirement accounts, and all of this is the rhetoric of the current administration. But on things like telco, it's, wait a minute, we know what's best for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder why.
To my mind, consumerism and paternalism are two sides to exactly the same coin. That the paternalistic companies think of us as consumers, my friend Jerry Mikulski says we're wallets with gullets. And so you grab the money and shove the
to be consumed commodity down the gullet. And to I would much prefer to think of the people who use the internet as citizens, customers, content producers. When you think about it, what is consumed when in an information application? Nothing. In fact, when I have an idea or read a blog post and I turn you onto that idea or blog post, now there's twice as much knowledge in the world as there was before. So if anything, we're not consumers when we share, we're producers. It's what Yochai Benkler calls pure production, we're producing more. So while I think that you're, you know, that you may have a point there where in some cases we see the head of the coin and in some cases we see the tails, I'm much more concerned about new forms of currency.
I have a question about network structure. People often talk about the edges of the network and the core of the network, and one or the other can be intelligent, but there's more than just the edge and the core to modern networks. They're pretty complicated.
Sure.
And there are a lot of intermediate layers, which have always had some level of intelligence. When we introduced the very first IP systems, you had to have some notion of DNS. People created these very distributed intelligent systems. You couldn't quite say, well, here it is, it's at this point. But they had a certain level of very basic structure. Once you have big data centers at nodes in an internet backbone, you have more intelligence gathered there. There are different kinds of routing algorithms that are being carried out in these centralized locations. How do you feel about, within this context of allowing free access and allowing everyone to be looking at the same stream of bits, how do you feel about intelligent systems in the middle between your network structure and the users?
I feel okay about it. Let me tell you how I think of intelligence and stupidity in the network. There's a lot of stuff in here, okay? But if you put a wire in that hole, it's just Ethernet. It's very simple, okay? MAC address, Ethernet, bits flow. At the other end of that wire, there's a lot of complicated stuff, but the point is the interface is clean. So I think of there can be a lot of complicated stuff that determines the routing of packets, but as long as a developer or a user can think of the internet as a cloud that they're plugging into, it's okay. Now, if there are cases where, for example, I don't know what kind of service, I'm not thinking too clearly, it's been a long day, but there are cases where you do need to do something with the contents out, quote, in the network, unquote. So, for example, here, IM, you know, I need to IM to you, but first I need to go to the IM server to find your IP address, okay? Is that in the network? I would contend it isn't. I would say that you're going back out and up to layer 7 where I'm finding you, and then it comes back to me, and then I talk to you. Are you in the network? No, I think you're also at the edge of the network. Okay, so I define the edge of the network as wherever you grab a packet, break it open, and look inside at the payload. Okay. So that's where the intelligence happens, where you open the packet and look at the payload. As long as the packet is closed and the network that's just delivering the bit stupid doesn't know what's in there and what's at the other end. That's my definition of a stupid network. So you can have services. You can have things that go, multi-hop out to this edge and out to that edge. But to think of those services as being in the network in some way, unless they're tightly integrated with the act of delivery, like if your ISP, what?
Like multicasting, for instance.
Uh-huh.
If you have a system that...
Ah, okay.
So if you're relying on something like multicasting, uh-huh. that means that at some point between you and your target users, some part of the network has to break open these packets.
You are right.
And say, who is going to watch this? How many people are paying attention to this?
You're right.
So,
Who is going to watch it and how many people are going to... I'd say that's an application. But multicast is truly a special case. It's a special task that IP does thanks to years and years of hard work by many, many smart people in the IETF. But I think it's a corner case. It is, you're right, it's...
You're
right.
You don't think we'll have more and more of these things?
What?
You don't think we'll have more and more of that level, that layer of intelligence?
We could, but frankly, my money is riding on multiple unicasts rather than a multicast. I think that the ability to do bandwidth, I mean, we went to 40 gigabits on each of 40 wavelengths on a single fiber, okay? And then stop. There's 100 gigabit technology sitting on the shelf in the laboratories that nobody's developing because we already have more than enough bandwidth to do everything. So I think, we'll get over this idea of multicast. I mean, we'll go to unicast except for those really weird corner cases like... the inauguration or something, and there it won't really be multicast, it'll be local caching of unicasts. I think multicast is asking IP to do way, way more than it should be doing. So no, I don't think, unless the Eslem Bolchis of the world actually take over, but I don't think they really have enough cognizance of the larger picture to succeed.
Okay. I want to come back to the earlier point about the cell phone network being as much of a walled garden as people say it is.
Mm-hmm. I think as a software guy who's spent a lot of time kind of thinking about how people approach new technology, I look at my phone and I guess I see a device that has actually the intelligence and the flexibility to be a kind of an end-to-end, like a node on an end-to-end network. But it just seems to me that no one's really figured out yet the experience to make that really stick. And you can start to see people going in that direction with all the things offered over SMS. Like there are lots of kind of end-to-end services offered mm-hmm. through that mm-hmm. kind of mm-hmm. through that kind of protocol. But I guess what I'm actually most interested to hear you about is really the role of the government. There have been all these attempts by different municipalities to provide public free Wi-Fi. There's the kind of the tension there with the private broadband providers, and also just what the government's role should be in regulating the internet in general. Like we haven't really said that much about that so far, and I'd just be interested to hear your thoughts.
Let's see. I don't do well with two very diverse questions, so I'll...
I'm less interested in the...
Well, let me just say one thing about that. They actually have a market test. If people wind up using EVDO, for example, which is the high-speed data service of a cellular network, for doing internet. And if the cellular companies let us do, e.g., you know, voice over IP over EVDO, and they realize that, hey, we're making enough money doing EVDO without having to, that we're locking in our customer for EVDO, and if we lose them as for voice, well, eventually we're going to lose them for voice, and so if they go like that, then they have a chance to survive, and that would be cool. If they instead start locking us out of the applications and make EVDO into another walled garden, their host, so or at least they open themselves up to a threat. Role of government. It depends on what you mean by government. Do you mean the UN? Do you mean the US? Do you mean China? Do you mean the Chinese government? Do you mean the city, state government, city government?
But I would like
my condo association, is that government? I mean, so the role of government, the ideal role, the actual role, et cetera, is different in every case, and it really boils down to, what all the different models of government, what you want government to do and to be in civil society.
I'm looking for an answer personally that ends with the words, and that's why we shall have the freedom to connect. So if you could just do the back half of that, because we're in our last 5 minutes. So.
I think we can close on that one.
No, I don't think so. So if you're head of the FCC, can I try it like this?
Sure, yeah.
So you've just been appointed in the, now that President Lessig has appointed you head of the FCC.
Uh-huh.
What's the directive that you give?
Gather up ye open spectrum and free it for the masses. The applications and the wires and switches shall be separate, and we understand you are your telephone companies, nice people work there, we want you to make a living. It's hard to make a living just running the wires and switches, so come unto me, my children, and I will regulate so that you all have careers, and that you and regulate so that the network that you run is one that you love, that you care about, and that you will help to maintain and grow for the national benefit.
Then this will be a stupid network.
That will be a stupid network.
You will make your money moving bits.
Moving bits. And you will charge enough so that you all have careers, and maybe even a little bit more. Maybe we'll add a nickel a month onto everybody's bill and fund something that we could call Bell Labs, something like that, which is how Bell Labs was. It was maybe more than a nickel a month, but not much more. And then all of these applications that run on this stupid network, we forbear from all regulation of those. Go out and kill each other just as long as you guys have access to this well-regulated, well-run, in the ideal of all possible worlds, we're here from the government and we're here to help you, network. All of these competitors should have access to the network and be free to compete. And may the best applications win. End of story. That's what I would do if I was FCC chairman.
Yeah. It's time. So we're
gonna bingo.
Calendar integrity.
Okay.
So thank you very much, David.
Thank you all for listening.